You would please open your Bibles to the latter portion of the book of 2 Samuel, chapter 21, is where I want to do some studying with you. Chapter 21, I have some questions that have been asked, and we'll try to deal with some of those and then move on into our study, on into chapter 24, and perhaps, time permitting, a little bit farther, I want to study some things in the Chronicles with you as well, as we look at parallel accounts. In our study tonight in chapter 21, we noted that there was famine in the days of David, 3 years, year after year, and David sought the face of Jehovah. Let me hasten to say, for those of you that are new in our class and visiting with us tonight, we're thankful that you're here, but our purpose in studying this series of lessons, as you'll notice on the board, we're talking about the history and geography of the Bible. We're looking extensively at maps, trying to locate places and remember where they are in relation to other places and understand some of these things from Old Testament history. We've talked about the land itself all the way back to the beginning, and we've talked about the promise of God as we are coupling with our study of history and geography, the importance of those things and the development of the scheme of redemption. In this, of course, we've had occasion to talk rather extensively about the providence of God. We're going to talk more about that as our studies progress and see the relationship of these events one to another. We've noted in the Garden of Eden that man had committed sin. From Genesis chapter 3 forward, we see the beginning of the development of the scheme of redemption. And we saw that nothing was said about the scheme of God to save man from sin from the point of Genesis 3:15 until we come to the time of Genesis chapter 12. Now, bear with me. I'm going to review very quickly, as quickly as I can. But the significance of Genesis chapter 3 is what? Bruce, 3:15, particularly.
Patient land and sea.
Not yet. Genesis 3.
Oh, Genesis 3. That Adam and Eve sinned, and God had set up a plan for redemption.
All right. And specifically in verse 15, the seed of woman would bruise the head of the serpent. And that becomes the first promise of redemption. We know then that we don't read anything about that for many generations until the time we come to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, where then we learn that God promises unto Abraham to make of him a great nation and give unto him a certain land, and then he said, in thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed. Now, we saw that seed promise. That develops the scheme of redemption, as I sometimes use that expression. That becomes the theme of the Bible. And we saw that promise not only made to Abraham when he was how old?
90.
All right. Before that,
75.
He was 75, yes. And then how old was he when the promised son was born? He was 100 years old. But we find that when the promised son was born, Isaac, that when he was a lad, what did God tell Abraham to do with him?
He was going to take him up on the mountain and offer him a sacrifice.
All right, did he do it?
Yeah.
How do you reason, Jim?
That God is able to bring him back from the dead.
That's right. And we learn that where? Hebrews 11:17. Yes, Hebrews 11:17. All right. And so he did, the text there tells us, in a figure, received him back. Abraham did not kill him, though he intended to. But we learned that this promise then was extended to young Isaac, same three promises. But in particular, the seed promise that we're focusing our attention upon. And where did we read about that? We remember Genesis 3, Genesis 12, now we're at Genesis 26. That's right, where Isaac was promised the same thing. Isaac had two sons. What were their names? Job, Isaac's two sons. That's it, Jacob and Esau. I can see it, just stick out your tongue and I'll read it. Jacob and Esau, that's right. And God chose to extend that promise through Jacob, that's right. And we read about that where?
Genesis
28. So now we got Genesis 3, Genesis 12, Genesis 26, and Genesis 28. All right, so we see that the sons of Jacob developed into tribes. Where did they develop into a group? great people, I guess is the question. In Egypt, that's right. Well, you remember that God had told Abraham that way back when, in Genesis chapter 15, when he told him that you're not going to get the land in your lifetime, but four generations from now, 400 years down the pipe, your descendants are going to come into this land. And if we remember anything about Genesis 15, I want you to remember the boundaries of the land, from the river Euphrates on the north, the river of Egypt on the south. You got your map pictured in your mind? Because that's what we want to remember. That marks the northern and southern boundaries of the land. And we see that land frequently referred to from Dan to Beersheba. Okay, that's the expression that we want to key in upon. And when they came up out of Egypt, of course, Moses, don't need to ask you that, led them up out of the land of Egypt. And Moses, as he brought them up out of the land of Egypt, he told them some things about this land. But before that, we want to note, when he brought them to Mount Sinai, God himself called them something. What did he call them? A holy nation. Yes, a holy nation. And where is it?
Exodus 19.
You were just waiting for me to ask that, weren't you? Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6. All right, so you check that one off. That's fulfilled. The nation promise has been fulfilled. That brings us to Exodus chapter 20, where God gave a law to that nation of people that he brought up out of the land of Egypt. And there's where we begin to read the Ten Commandments. And you want to remember that from Exodus chapter 20 and Deuteronomy chapter 5. There's the parallel text of that. And we note that that law had not been made, Moses said, with our fathers, but with us, even us who are all of us here alive this day. Which tells us that the Ten Commandments, or the law of Moses, if you please, was not a general law that was given to everybody, was it? It was given to that nation. God brought us out of the land of Egypt, the nation of Israel. And by the way, Randy, why do we call it the nation of Israel? Why do we refer to the 12 tribes of Israel?
Because they're all the sons of Jacob. God made this one.
That's right. All right, everybody heard that? Okay, very good. So we've got that nailed down. Now, while Moses was bringing them up out of the land of Egypt, he told them in the wilderness that when you are brought into the land, if you worship and serve other gods, what's going to happen to you? You're going to lose the land. He'll take it away from you. Now, they haven't even got it yet. But Moses said, when you do this, here's what God's going to do. Now, we looked at three contexts in the book of Deuteronomy where we found that. Deuteronomy, where is it found? David?
Deuteronomy 4.
4. Picking your brain.
8,
and then there are
28 through 30.
That's right. 28 through 30. And that becomes definitive. We took the time and studied that a number of times, so we want to remember that. So they've been brought by Moses to Kadesh Barnea, whereupon spies are sent into the land, spy out the land, and that brings us to Numbers chapter 13 and 14. Where the spies come back, what kind of a report, David?
Yeah, it's not what you said. Got people over there, but they just looks like it's too hard to go into.
All right.
So, how does the people report then? That Joshua and Caleb thought different than we did.
All right, what'd they say?
That we can go in, if we can take it.
And what do the people want to do to them? Stone them to death. Don't kill them. That's right. All right. Let's remember that. Now, Joshua and Caleb then had good words, the others did not. What happened to those who did not, and what happened to those who believed the testimony of the evil report?
They did get killed once again.
All right. How long did it take them to die? 38 more years. That's right. Total wandering in the wilderness, 40 years. For that generation to die. That was under the leadership of Moses. Then Moses is taken upon Mount Nebo, and he dies on Mount Nebo.
That means they were ready to go in right there 38 years sooner. But
they could.
Because of that, they've wondered.
That's exactly right.
Wow.
Yeah.
38 more years.
Yeah, and they
Hebrew writer tells us in Hebrews chapter 3 and 4, he calls that unbelief. And you see why? They didn't believe God. Joshua and Caleb did.
That's exactly what it is.
Okay. All right. So Moses goes upon Mount Nebo. I want you to remember this chapter. Where is it in the text that Moses is taken upon Mount Nebo and is privileged to see the land? Where do we read about that? It is the last chapter. Deuteronomy chapter 34. Deuteronomy chapter 34. We'll begin reading in verse 1 of that text. When you get down to about verses 3 or 4 thereabouts, you'll note that Moses is privileged to see the land, and the importance of that, it says, which I promised unto the fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You see that there? Deuteronomy 34. About what is it? Verse 3, verse 4? Verse 4. Thank you. Okay? The reason I want you to see that is it ties it to the promise, the land promise that was made way back here to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12, initially Genesis chapter 15 as the borders were identified. All right, we've got that now. That ends the book of Deuteronomy. That brings us over then to the book of Joshua. Yes?
I'm sorry. I read or heard somewhere in the past that since Moses died in the last chapter, was it possible that Joshua to finish the last chapter or two for Moses?
You mean the writing of it?
The writing of it.
I don't know that I ever thought about that. I don't know.
I think I read it on computers.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Fact is, it's written, and so we've got the record of Moses seeing that. I don't know. I never thought about that. I have to give that some consideration. But when we come into the book of Joshua, what's promised unto Joshua? All right, he's promised to be the one who will bring the children of Israel into the promised land. That's right, chapter 1. Now, when we come to Joshua chapter 6, Joshua chapter 6, the first city of conquest, Jericho, the city of Jericho. The next city, Ai, chapter 7. And so by the time we get to the 11th chapter, toward the end of that chapter, we note that Joshua tells us that all the land has been conquered. Joshua chapter 12 is a review of all of that. And Joshua chapter 13 through basically the end of the book is the division of the tribes or the land among the tribes. Now, when you come to Joshua, this is what I want you to remember. Chapter 21 and Joshua chapter 23. Joshua chapter 21 in verses 44 and 45, Claire, Joshua chapter 21, verses 44 and 45, what does Joshua assure the people that God has done? You remember? Okay. Now we'll help her out. That's right. He fulfilled the promise. He kept everything. Not one thing has failed. Notice the wording of that. God gave you the land, you possessed the land, and you dwelt in the land. Those are three words I want you to remember, as well as that expression, not one thing hath failed. Now, somebody mentioned Joshua 23, where Joshua stated that again, verses 14 through 16. This goes in your list, okay? Joshua 23, verses 14 through 16. And there, Paul, you want to join us? What's in Joshua 23, 14 through 16? Can you read that for me, please? I'm impressed with these electronic Bibles. Joshua chapter 23, verses 14 through 16. Please.
And behold, this day I informed the way of all the earth. And you know in all your heart and all your souls that no one thing hath failed of all the good things which the Lord your God spake concerning you. All of our accounts pass unto you, and not one thing hath failed to kill.
All the way through 16.
Therefore it shall come to pass that as all good things are come upon you which the Lord your God promised you, so shall the Lord bring upon you all the evil things, until he hath destroyed you from off this good land which the Lord your God hath given you. And when ye have transgressed the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, and have gone and served other gods, and bow yourself to him. Then shall the anger of the Lord be kindled against you, and he shall perish quickly from off the land which he hath given unto you.
Alright. What's he telling you?
If you worship other gods, what's God going to do to you?
Curse
you. He's going to destroy you. He'll take this land away from you. Do we see that? Now, you can't take something away that you don't already have. So Joshua tells them, you've got it. God blessed you with it. He did everything he promised to do. Not one thing failed. But if you worship idols, here's what he's going to do. Don't ever forget that. These series of passages are important in our timeline discussion. We note them that during the period of Joshua, Joshua said God did everything he said he would do. Check that one off. Land promise has been fulfilled. Okay? We note that Moses had already told them also, in addition to the losing of the land, if you worship idols, even before they came in and took the land. He'd also told them that the time's going to come when you're going to ask for a king. You'll want a king. And where did he say that? This is a passage that needs to be in your list. Where did he say that? You'll want a king. Lynn?
Deuteronomy 17.
Yes. Now, when you take a king, you can only have this kind of king. It has to be one from among you. Can't go over here and get one from another nation. It has to be one of you. And there are some requirements that are imposed upon the kings. And what are some of them?
Can't start collecting wives.
No.
Can't start collecting riches.
No.
Horses.
No. Can't make any allegiances with Egypt or return to Egypt. All these kinds. You left all that behind. And so we see that in Deuteronomy chapter 17. That becomes very significant because when we come to the period then of the judges, right after Joshua, we know that the people ask for a king. Who's the last of the judges, by the way? Samuel was. His sons were not faithful. Samuel was the last of the judges, and the people came and asked Samuel. They said, we want a king. Go before us. Be like the other nations around about us. Everybody wants to be like everybody else, don't they? We don't want to be distinct.
Just an observation about the passage that was just read. We see that they're continuing to be right with God, continuing to be in the promised land. It's contingent upon their obedience. In other words, if they disobey, they could lose it.
Yes.
And that, in principle, you could refer to that. I know we don't live under the old law, and you can't maybe use old law passages as proof text. But for us today, as a new law, but at least in principle, I think you can refer back to those passages to at least make the argument that God, in his consistency, would not allow us today under the new law to be in a situation where we can't lose it. You know, I'm referring to the once saved, always saved doctrine that people teach, that once you become saved, there's nothing you can do to lose it. Well, if that's the case, then why do we see that back then, that they were warned by God, you can lose it. If you disobey me, you don't continue to obey me.
You mean that establishes a precedent?
Yes, it does.
Isn't that marvelous?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Is that you can point back to those passages to show that back then God told them, if you turn back and live in sin, you can lose it. And I think we could use that to make the case today that once we become saved, if you so choose to, you can lose it.
That's pretty much what Paul was saying, wasn't it? In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, he talked about the nation of Israel coming out of the land of Egypt. They were baptized in the cloud and the sea with this relationship with Moses, but with not all of them was God well pleased, and he begins to establish what they did during that period of time, how so many of them perished. And then he said, wherefore let him think and stand and take heed lest he fall. Yeah, right in there.
But it's more than just what people think. They're losing spiritually. And they're also losing their lives beneath the men.
Well, that's right. You lose your soul. And that's the point, of course, that we're cultivating here. Now, let's move on. We talk about the period of the judges after the conquering of the land. How long was that period? About 300 years. How many judges? Including Abimelech. Pardon me? 15. All right, including Abimelech. That's 15. All right. And when we look at that, we see a cycle of faithfulness, then idolatry, then oppression. And then they cry to God in repentance, and God sends a deliverer, a judge, and then faithfulness, and round the wind. through that cycle. That's the period of the judges. And when they wound up in the period of the judges, every man did as he pleased, did what he wanted to. Now, then that begins, of course, the period of the last of the judges was Samuel, when Samuel was asked for king. Who became the first king?
Saul.
Saul became the first king. That's right, son of Kish. Of course, we note the kind of character that he was. What kind of man was he initially? Yeah, but that didn't last, did it? He became arrogant in chapter 13, then again in chapter 15. What did he do in chapter 13? Jenny?
In chapter 13, he was told to wait for Samuel in Gilgal before going up to battle. And he got antsy and decided that he wanted to go ahead and offer the sacrifices so they could hurry up and go off to battle before all his army left.
All right. Well put. He got answered. Philistines in innumerable numbers were just about to overwhelm him, and his army was scattering. Antsy might describe it. So he went off with the sacrifice, which he was not supposed to do. What did he do in chapter 15?
He did not destroy the Amalekites.
All right, he did not destroy the Amalekites. Chapter 15. Good job. He did not destroy the Amalekites. And he spared them and brought back the best of the Amalekites. And when Samuel asked him, why did you do that? He said, well, the people did that. He brought them back as a sacrifice. And of course, God didn't ask for a sacrifice. He said, behold, to obey is better than sacrifice. All right. Saul began to go south from there on. In fact, we see a conflict between David and Saul. Saul was intent on killing David. Tried to nail him to the wall with his spear and sought his life. And we talked about where, and we chased David all over the map. And then we know that the Lord was no longer talking to Saul. And Saul went to the witch of Endor. We talked about that. Now that Samuel then, apparently raised from the dead, told Saul that tomorrow you're going to be dead, you and your sons. Well, Saul's sons were killed in battle, and how did Saul die? He killed himself, fell on his sword. He was injured, he fell on his sword, and killed himself. Well, who then was eventually appointed or recognized by the people to be king? He'd already been anointed.
That is in contrast between the Old Testament Saul and the New Testament Saul. This Saul started out with the Old Testament as humble, and went into the New Testament. Persecuting Christians.
Okay. The other way. All right, that'll make you a sermon. You'll have to put that together. That'll work. All right. Well, as we continue to talk about David being appointed as king, David started out a very good king. And for the most part was a good king. However, we note on the chart that he's a man after God's own heart. He was not perfect, which is indicated when we come to 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel is chapter 11. What was it that David did?
He stole another man's wife.
Stole another man's wife. He did a lot of things in that chapter. He coveted another man's wife. He committed adultery with another man's wife. He plotted the murder of her husband. And then he had that plot carried out and then explained it away with hypocrisy by saying one dies in battle just like another. Not good. So David finally realized what he had done, as Nathan the prophet told him what he had done by relating a parable to him. And when David realized what he had done, he said, I have sinned. And Nathan said, you're not going to die, but the child that is to be born will die. There will be war in your house, there will be troubles in your family, and so what? Somebody tell me about the troubles in David's family. What? What happened in his family?
Well, there was, I know that
Amnon.
And then when the brother got mad and avenged his death, David sent him away, and then this old lady came up to him because somebody else sent her. There's a lot of somebody's else, sorry.
Yeah.
And somebody sent her to go and say, hey, this happened to my family, it's like a similar situation. And then he was like, oh, well, you know, like, your family's going to be fine, I will take care of everything. And then she's like, well, then why didn't you do that for your own son?
All right.
David then decides to call his son back, and then, but doesn't talk to him for like 2 years.
All right. And that just kind of goes in one thing to another. And then we find that this son, Absalom was his name, Absalom decided that he wanted to be king instead of his father. And so he began to grant favors to the people, and the people became loyal to him, and the kingdom nearly divided. And Absalom has an army, and David leaves Jerusalem and goes into the Transjordan side of the land to Mahanaim. And about there, a battle ensues between David's army and Absalom's army, and make a long story short, Absalom is killed. David just grieves his heart out, even to the extent of nearly losing the loyalty of the people. Well, David then regains the loyalty of the people, chapter 19, and that brings us over then to chapter 20, where there is another rebellion against David's rule in David's kingdom. Who's it led by?
Sheba,
that's right. And Joab, the captain of David's army, is seeking Sheba. And Sheba is protected by a particular city whose name I can't remember. You see that there? Somebody point that out to me. I don't see it. It's chapter 21, beginning of verse 16. Yeah, what you said.
Right.
And so, when he begins to surround the city, a wise woman says, why do you have all against this city? And he says, I want Sheba. And if you'll give me Sheba, I'll spare the city. And the woman converted the people, and then what happened?
And the plan took care of Sheba.
All right, the head of Sheba went flying over the fence and came over to David, and David went home. And, pardon me?
Joab
went home. Thank you. Joab went home. Well, that brings us to chapter 21. Regarding the events that I wanted to talk with you about, this famine. Randy, you had some questions about this famine in the days of David. 3 years, year after year, David besought the Lord because of this famine. And we learned that Saul had killed a bunch of the Gibeonites when an agreement had been made by Joshua in Joshua chapter 9 that the Gibeonites were to be treated kindly. And, of course, they had deceived Joshua and his army, but the agreement had nonetheless been made, and it was to be honored. And Saul did not honor it. And consequently, this famine comes upon the Gibeonites. Well, David raises the question, what will it take to make this go away, to satisfy you? And what did the Gibeonites tell him? We don't want gold or silver.
Seven sons of Saul.
Now, we note that David spared Mephibosheth. Why? That's right. He had a pact or an oath or a covenant with Jonathan, Saul's son. Mephibosheth was Saul's grandson. And Jonathan, of course, was Saul's very dear friend. But the king took two sons of Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah, whom she bare unto Saul, and then the five sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul. Now, there were some questions about the five sons of Michal, the daughter of Saul, when we note that when Michal was returned to David, what did David do with her? You recall that Saul had given her to someone else to become that person's wife. And when David got her back, what did he do with her?
Essentially banished her to house
imprisonment. All right, yeah. So she never did have any children. And the question then is raised, how is it that here five sons of Michal were delivered to the Gibeonites to be killed or to be hanged? And that's a good question. Makes a lot of folks scratch their heads. Did a lot of reading about that, or a good bit. And most suppose that these five sons were actually five sons of Moreh, who was married to Adriel, as well as Michal. Now, some have supposed that perhaps Merib had died and that Michal had raised these children. That's speculation from the get-go. You don't know that. But what we do know is that the text has to be consistent, and Michael didn't have any children. So it is possible that a scribe got the name wrong here. I don't know. That's how some have tried to explain it or to reconcile that. But it's a good question nonetheless, and frankly I don't know a definitive answer to that. Many scholars take that position and suppose that to be the case. But be that as it may, we notice that Rizpah, how does she respond to her son's being killed?
Just take the kindly to it.
No, that one wouldn't. What did she do about it?
She kept the wild animals away from the dead bodies.
She did. She kept the wild animals away from the dead bodies. And David saw that this thing needs closure, and what did he do? Okay.
How do we know that Michael didn't have any children?
Well, if you'll turn back in the text to 1 Samuel chapter 18. Get back there. Well, first of all, in 1 Samuel chapter 18, let's take them as they come. In 1 Samuel chapter 18, this is going way back now in history, you'll notice that David said to Saul, "Who am I and what is my life or my father's family in Israel, that I should be son-in-law to the king?" But it came to pass at the time when Merib, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel, the Maholathite, to wife, and Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David. Well, we learned the rest of this, that Saul said that's a good thing. He thought that Michal might be a snare to him. We notice in the 19th chapter that Michal let David down through the roof, or down through the window, rather, and he fled, and this was the beginning of the searching for David by King Saul and Saul's efforts to kill him and so forth and so on. And in the meantime, we know that King Saul gave Michal to be the wife of, pardon me?
Palti,
thank you. Couldn't come up with that. And when efforts to reunite the kingdom between Joab and Abner occurred, we know that, let me get to the passage here, in chapter 3 of 2 Samuel. Chapter 3 of 2 Samuel. Pick up the reading there about verse 14. It says, David sent messengers to Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, saying, "Deliver me my wife Michal, whom I betrothed to me, for 100 foreskins of the Philistines." And Ish-bosheth sent and took her from her husband, even from Palti, the son of Laish, and her husband went with her, weeping as he went, and followed her to Bahurim. Then said Abner unto him, "Go, return," and he returned. So Abner brings David his wife. But as you drop down further in the text to, let me find it, chapter 6, yes, the end of the chapter there, Randy. Beginning about verse 22, I guess, will get us to the point. It said, "And I will be yet more vile than this, and I will be base in mine own sight, but of the handmaids of whom thou hast spoken, of them shall I be had in honor." And here's the verse. "And Michal, the daughter of Saul, had no child unto the day of her death."
But maybe, couldn't it have been that when she was with Palti that she had children?
Well, you see, that's what we're doing. We're supposing. I don't know. I can't answer that.
It just makes more sense that it's a transcription error because all of the usages of Merab and the fact that it's Adriel and the Maholathite and all that sort of stuff.
So that's all consistent.
Here in 2 Samuel 20, whatever it is. We're
21.
It talks about Adriel the Maholathite. Mm-hmm. And Adriel the Maholathite was married to Michael's sister, Merab.
Yes.
So it's more reasonable to think that we have a scribal transcription error here.
That's what most scholars say. Yes.
And it certainly doesn't change passages that are here.
That's right. Yeah, I think it's supposition to go beyond that. We just need to let that be right there.
What exactly is the transcription?
Pardon me?
What is the transcription error that you make the reference to?
In chapter 21, verse 8, you notice the five sons of Michael, the daughter of Saul. Instead of Michael, it is believed that the word should be Merib.
Oh, that's an actual substitute.
Okay. Some translations then render it that way. Some, as in the American Standard, footnote it that way. Some use Michael. And that's the explanation of that variant reading. Okay? So that's the passages that's involved in your question. Now, we know that regarding Rezpah, the daughter of Aiah, and how that she was mourning and keeping the wild animals and so forth away from the bodies of her sons, David brought that thing to close. What did he do?
He took the bodies from the
All right, he buried them, and he went and got the bodies of Saul and his sons, and he buried them at the sepulcher of Kish, the family burial site, as it were, an honorable burial. All right. Any other questions or comments just here? Well, we want to note in the remainder of this chapter that David's battles with the Philistines continue in chapter 21. You'll note in verse 15 that he fought against the Philistines. And then you'll note in chapter 21, verse 18, again, war with the Philistines. Verse 19, there was again war with the Philistines. And then in verse 20, there was again war at Gath. Where was that, by the way? That was a city of the Philistines. And you remember some other things, perhaps, about Gath in relation to Goliath being from Gath. But be that as it may, we note that there were other men of great stature, giants, as it were, in Gath. Verse 20 tells us of a man who had six fingers on both of his hands and six toes on both of his feet. But these giants were killed in the war with the Philistines. Now, when you... Pardon me? Yes, he did. Where David fled. Now, look on the chart, and we see all the troubles that David had in his kingdom. The rebellion of Absalom. Absalom killed. David restored his king. The rebellion of Sheba. Sheba beheaded and cast over the wall. And then we see continued problems with the Philistines. And as we come to chapter 24, I want to jump ahead and then come back here just a little bit because of several things, but time being an element. We note in chapter 24 that David numbers the people. He numbers the people in chapter 24. Beginning in verse 1, it says, "And again the anger of Jehovah was kindled against Israel, and he moved David against them, saying, Go number Israel and Judah." Question might legitimately be asked, well, why did he do that? In verse 2 and following, we know that Joab, the captain of his army, or the main captain, I guess you'd say, of his army, was instructed to go from Dan to Beersheba. You see that? From all these cities and provinces and number the people. And Joab objects. Look at verse 3. "And Joab said unto the king, Now Jehovah thy God add unto the people how many soever there may be, 100-fold. And may the eyes of my lord the king see it. But why doth my lord the king delight in this thing?" Now, Joab sees something wrong with this, doesn't he? Does he have any valid reason to object for David numbering the people? What's Joab's argument, Randy?
Can you read verse 1?
Verse 1, "And again the anger of Jehovah was kindled against Israel, and he moved David against them, saying, Go number Israel and Judah."
The New American Standard says, "Now again the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and it incited David against them."
Ah, all right. but hold your finger there and turn over, if you will, to 1 Chronicles 21. 1 Chronicles 21. And one of the things we want to remember is that the Chronicles often gives us a parallel account of the same event. Sometimes that's helpful, isn't it? It gives us more information. Look at 1 Chronicles 21. And Randy, if you would please read for me verse 1.
1 Chronicles 21, verse 1. Then Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel.
Well, why did David number Israel?
Satan stood up against Israel.
Yeah. Elaborate on that, if you would, please.
I don't know if I want to.
Well, we've got a problem here that gets the people of God into a whole lot of trouble. Let's read, if you will, please, at verse 3 of chapter 21, 1 Chronicles, please. Verse 3.
Joab said, "May the Lord add to his people 100 times as many as they are. What, my lord the king, are they not all my lord's servants? Why does my lord seek this thing? Why should he be a cause of guilt to Israel?"
All right. Joab again objects. The wording here is a little bit different, but why does Joab object?
Well, because all of them are not Israelites.
Well, yeah, but from Dan to Beersheba, he's wanting to number the people of Israel and Judah.
Well, for one thing,
what's wrong with
job.
You? Pardon me?
For one thing, it's a big job.
It is, yes. Very time consuming.
For another thing, it doesn't matter how many your number is, if God's on your side.
Isn't that Joab's point? If God adds a whole bunch of folks to the number that we get, what difference does it make? It doesn't make any difference. Now, when David wants to number the people, let us understand that numbering the people is not just simply to take a census to see how many people we have. The general purpose of numbering the people, you'll notice in the text, is to number those who are 20 years old and older. Does that sound familiar? Now, why would David be concerned about the number of people that are fighting age?
The draft.
The draft. Yes. Why is David concerned about his army? Does it really make any difference how many people he has in his army?
Well, you know, from the standpoint of a leader, how does Sheba get all of Israel to follow him? He said, "I'm king." And it says, all of Israel turned to Sheba and served him. Well, if that's all it takes to get somebody's allegiance away from the king, it's just that we go, "No, he's not king, I'm king." And then everybody turns towards Sheba. Well, it sounds like he was a little insecure in his kingship.
All right, that insecurity. Let's talk about that a little bit. Was it in himself as king? Or was it in... Yeah, it might appear to other nations that way, but where was David's lack of confidence?
Apparently God views David's decision to do this as a lack of faith and confidence in him.
The reason in the verse 9, he goes back and he sees a soothsayer to get answers. He's not looking for answers from God.
Aren't you talking about Saul?
Verse 9 says,
of which chapter? Chronicles or Samuel?
First Chronicles.
Oh, okay, okay.
It says, and the Lord spake to Gad, David's seer.
All right. Let's understand, though, that a seer doesn't necessarily mean somebody that's doing something that's wrong. A seer is the equivalent of a prophet. Okay, it doesn't necessarily mean that this is an enchanter or a soothsayer. But you're right, David does talk to Gad about this, but I think the overwhelming thing we need to see here is that David's confidence is lacking in God. That's why this is such a big problem. Joab sees that, and who better to know it than Joab, the captain of your army? He's been out there fighting these battles, and if God is for us, then what? It doesn't make a difference how many people you have. Did we not observe that Jonathan and Jonathan's armor bearer challenged the garrison of the Philistines with an army of two? And what was their argument? We saw that the Philistines were described as innumerable. Now, granted, they had all kinds of garrisons where they're scattered about, but at this one garrison, there were a lot of people. And Jonathan and his armor bearer attacked the garrison, and they killed a lot of people. And what was the reasoning of Jonathan? You see, God doesn't fight with numbers. I mean, it depends how many people we have. Well, evidently, David's lost sight of that, at least momentarily. And he thinks that it's necessary to number the people. But with God, Joab's point, we're 100 times our number. It doesn't make any difference how many people we have. Okay. Okay, so that was a mess up on Saul's part back in those days. That's right. But now, because of what David did, we know that the thing displeased God, and God smote Israel. Keep your fingers at 1 Chronicles 21 and 2 Samuel 24 for the reading of the parallel account. But God smote Israel in chapter 24 of 2 Samuel. In verse 10, David acknowledges his sin, and he says, "I have done very foolishly." Now, God gives David a choice, multiple choice. What was it? Here's the consequences of what you've done. You pick the consequences. Number one, verse 13 of chapter 24, 2 Samuel. 7 years of famine come upon the land. Now, we're familiar with what just a few years of famine did during the days of Joseph. And you remember how that with just 2 years into the famine, Joseph's family has come down to Egypt twice, remember that? Just to live. Now, famine, bad thing. We don't know anything about famine in this country. But they did there. Now, David, you can have 7 years of famine. You saw what 2 years meant during the lifetime of Joseph. And there were 7 years that Joseph had prophesied. So he brought his family down to Egypt to care for them. Now, you can have that, or what else? You can flee 3 months from your enemies while they pursue you. Does David have any experience with this fleeing? Oh yeah, he knows what it is to run. He's been chased by Saul for quite some time. He knows about that. Well, that's not very desirable. And then the third one, or there shall be 3 days pestilence in the land. Now, some will say, well, what was the pestilence? Well, you don't know. It doesn't tell you what that was. I don't know what that was. Don't know if it was disease or really what it was. It doesn't tell us. Pestilence in the land. Now, there's a difference between the famine and the fleeing from your enemies and pestilence. What was the difference? Got two over here and one over here. What was the difference?
Two
affect
everybody.
One affects you. Okay. Yeah.
One is the length of time.
All right. The length of time. You've got the 7 years, and then you've got the 3 months. And then you've got 3 days. That's right.
Maybe even severity.
All right, maybe even severity. What would that be determined by?
We'll never
know. Oh, we'll never, as long as you could have said. We'll never know. Well, you think about the difference in these things, and we'll start with that next time. I want you to read carefully as well, if you would please, between now and Sunday morning, chapter 22 and 23, because we're going to note in those chapters the what we will call Psalms of Praise from David as they're recorded in these verses. I would also like for you to continue reading on into 1 Kings, because there are a number of events in 1 Kings that help us a little bit with this history study. And while you have your Bible open there to the Chronicles, there, beginning in chapter 21. If you read quite a little bit farther beyond chapter 21, just keep reading there in the book of 1 Chronicles, and we'll see some other things that David did that we don't find in 2 Samuel. Okay? So that's our study now for Sunday.